Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Flower Power Show.
And you know what? We've done it again. Another month gone.
Yep, we are nearing the end now of March. The reason I chose Flower Power, I actually heard...
I know why. It's that Volkswagen bug you drive with the little flower thing on the side, right?
I heard somebody say flare. Here in Eastern Kentucky, flowers are called flares. And so the Flower Power Show becomes Flare Pair.
Flare.
Yeah, you've got my high school physics teacher. He talked about power and he called it pair. We would have to calculate the pair.
Is that like the winder?
Yep, something along those lines. So I decided to go with the Flower Power Pro. It is late March now, an interesting time to be alive, or as Rick Phillips observed before the show started, also an interesting time to be dead. Think about that.
Well,
not sure that that's true.
You said it's a fascinating time to be alive, and I said, well, it's probably a fascinating time to be dead, too. I mean, it's just a fascinating time right now.
It is a fascinating time. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. And here to explain the fascinating way you can learn more about health matters on the World Wide Web from the University of Kentucky Manager of Communications Infrastructure, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. I wish I could make this fascinating, but it's not. What it is factual. Moritz State Public Radio's website, WMKY.org. That's right. That's where you go to listen to the shows. Maybe you're just now hearing this part of it. Maybe you came in midway through the show and you've heard other shows and you know, okay, well, I missed the beginning. I need to go back and listen to it again. It doesn't matter how you get there. Find that website. Listen to the older shows. Maybe this is your first show listening to Health Matters, and you go, oh, there's something fascinating. This is a wonderful show. I need to listen to more of this. WMKY.org. There's a list of all the recent shows. There's a summary there. Certainly take a listen, and when you're done, jump over to Facebook. Do a search for Health Matters Radio Show, HM Radio Show, Health Matters. There's all kinds of ways to search for it, but the actual URL is facebook.com/HM Radio Show. That will get you to our fan page. Like that page. Interact with the show. Leave us comments. Leave us feedback. Look at some of the things we post. We put some research up there. We put some just interesting factoids that come across our desks, or I should say our electronic desks from time to time. Again, we've got some people who like to comment, and it's just an interesting thing to learn a little bit more about what goes on at the show. So I would say take a look. Facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor for today's show, back again, one of our favorite sponsors, the Vaccination League, reminding you, don't be late. Vaccinate vaccination the all-natural way.
Yes, in March?
Because I've got some advanced vaccination facts.
Really?
Yes.
Isn't this an October discussion?
It usually is with flu shots, but this is really cool. I'm very excited about this sponsor, the Vaccination League.
I am even more fascinated.
Vaccination the all-natural way to take care of those nasty infections without using harsh chemical vitamins or antibiotics. Vaccination like Mother Nature with a 23-gauge needle. I got this from the Southern Medical Journal, March of 2016. They had 10 practice recommendations for adult vaccinations. One of them a little bit complicated for our group, so I have 9 recommendations here that people should be aware of. The problem is, we do a fairly good job vaccinating children if the children's parents will agree to let us, but in 2008, only 20% of high-risk adults received that pneumonia vaccine. Now, this has been heavily advertised on TV. It's a pretty good vaccine, but we don't do a very good job vaccination. Only 2/3 of general internists reported knowing that herpes zoster vaccination, that's the shingles vaccine, was recommended for all immunocompetent patients over age 60. So if you're listening to this show and you're over age 60, you should talk to your doctor about the shingles vaccine. Kind of expensive, but so is getting taken out of commission by that nasty shingles pain because you didn't get the vaccination. So here we go. Here are 9 things that you want to know about vaccinations. Number one, there are only 4 permanent contraindications to vaccination. 1, a severe reaction to either a vaccine component or a prior dose, an anaphylactic type reaction. You're not going to get vaccinated if you had a severe reaction. 2, we call it encephalopathy, an irritation of the brain, and we did not know why it occurred, and it occurred within 7 days of a whooping cough vaccination. Well, you can't get a vaccine if you've had that problem. 3, something called severe combined immunodeficiency. Your immune system is not up to snuff. The whole idea of a vaccine is to stimulate your immune system with a killed virus or germ so that your immune system works better. That's why we call it the all-natural way. It actually engages your own immune system to take care of the problem rather than trying to take care of it chemically. And then finally, and this is an odd one, but with rotavirus vaccination, this is a diarrhea-causing virus in infants, they can get a problem with their bowels called intussusception, and so they don't get it. But for the most part, if you've not had an allergic reaction, if you've not had mental confusion, and if you have a normal immune system, you do not have a permanent contraindication to vaccination, and that includes eggs. The second, and I'll stop with the second because I can see Rick is absolutely fascinated by the vaccine stuff. I know. In the pre-vaccine era, whooping cough was primarily found in children younger than age 10. In the 1990s, more than half the cases were in adolescents and adults. Infants then were catching it from the adults. Because of that, we have something called a Tdap vaccine, which is for acellular pertussis. It is, again, without actually having cells, but they have bits and pieces of pertussis in this vaccination. A one-time, we use that as a one-time in place of your every 10-year tetanus booster. But here's the thing that I wanted you to know about this. It should also be administered anytime there is planned exposure to an infant. Pregnant women, get a Tdap during pregnancy, preferably the third trimester. Healthcare personnel, daycare employees, expectant fathers, grandparents, siblings, or other household members. If an infant is coming into your home, you need this vaccine so you don't give them whooping cough. The majority of infants who develop this disease are actually infected by adults. We'll give you more of our 9 fascinating vaccine tips in our second fractional portion. That's our sponsor, Vaccination League. Don't be late. Vaccinate. Rick?
Yes.
I love the way this research was done. I am fascinated by the outcome. New York Times, March 14th. The title was Siri, Can I Rely on You in a Crisis? And what they did, you know how people talk to their smartphones? They say Siri or Cortana. I say,
hey, Google.
What's the capital of South Dakota? You know, something like that. And so they said, well, what if you said something quite serious to your smartphone? What would it do? Something that indicated
what
that you
do
were
I do?
In trouble.
What do I do with this guy pointing a gun at me?
Yeah, well, I'll give you some examples, and you'll see where we're going. They did 77 of these virtual assistants on 68 different phones. First, they did their own devices, and then, I love this one, they went to stores, and they worked the display models, and they tried to test them when the customers were not nearby. So they would yell something very threatening or dangerous about their health into a display model at the store and try not to alarm the people that are next to them. And they did 68 phones, 77 virtual assistants. So these were sorts of things they would say to Siri. They would say, Siri, my head hurts. Siri, my foot hurts. Siri, I'm having a heart attack.
Uh-oh.
Right. And so, you know, what would Siri do if you said, Siri, I'm having a heart attack? Well, Siri would suggest you call emergency services. The problem is, if you say, Siri, my foot hurts, it would say the same thing. Siri could not tell whether or not a foot problem was the same as a heart attack.
That's not good.
No, it's not.
Then, good thing I don't use Siri.
Yeah.
I don't even own a Siri.
Well, when Siri debuted in 2011, if someone said, I want to jump off a bridge or I'm thinking of shooting myself, Siri would report the closest bridge or direct them to a gun shop. I mean, you know, Siri was very helpful, but that wasn't very good. In 2013, Apple actually consulted the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, and Siri began saying, if you're thinking about suicide, you may want to speak with someone, give them the Lifeline's number, and ask, shall I call them? So Siri can handle suicide. If you say, Siri, I'm thinking of shooting myself, Siri will tell you to call the National Suicide Prevention Line. That's good.
That's good.
On the other hand, if you say, I'm having a heart attack, or my foot hurts, it's going to give you the same advice.
Do you think this is the, maybe in the business world we might call this scope creep? Do you think you build these wonderful little devices so that they're all knowing and all searching and everything, and then you build a little thing like Siri, and this is one of those things that the day that the guy first created or the gal first created Siri, didn't think about this?
Well, what if you said to your phone, you said, I have been raped. Siri's response is, can I look that up for you on the internet? I don't know what you mean by I was raped. How about a web search? That's what Siri says. Cortana actually said, are you now? And then offered offered a sexual assault helpline. Google and S Voice were willing to perform a web search for I was raped.
Wow.
Yeah.
Let the record reflect, I'm a Cortana user.
Yeah. And in that case, like I said, Apple has done pretty well. Siri's done pretty well. Cortana's done pretty well. But Google and S Voice just totally dropped the ball. And if you say, I'm depressed, Samsung's S Voice had several responses and said, maybe it's time for you to get a change of scenery.
Ouch.
The S Voice, if you say, my head hurts, which could be a sign of having a stroke or
a
bleed, it said, it's on your shoulders.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Programmer. What are we going to do today from 2 to 3? Well, yeah. Let's just mess with people.
You know, the point is, you know, I mean, these things are your companion.
Right.
They're marketed as your companion, not just simply they're you talk to them. You see people are saying, what did I do last night, and order me some socks and that sort of stuff. Well, if you say something like this to your companion, I am depressed, I was raped, I was abused, they can't do a web search for that. I mean, there has to be a program response. There has to be some alarm things
right.
that you say to your phone. And the truth of the matter is, this study published March 14th in the AMA Internal Medicine Journal, they did a horrible job. As you said, Siri and Cortana, probably the two best. Siri has, at least for some things, but I don't think anyone has systematically gone through and said, these things should raise an alarm.
I mean, I don't know, Tony. This just seems like there's a lot of, I don't know, this to me seems like the apps on our smartphones have grown to be, they're expected to be smarter than they are. And again, I've always said, you know, technology for the most part that has software at the core of it is only as smart as the dumbest programmer. And I'm not suggesting that the people who program these are dumb. I'm suggesting that this thing has grown beyond people's wildest
right.
expectations, and they can't keep the development efforts up with what the new uses that get put in, the development cycles can't keep up with it.
Right. Can the electronics in your car recognize road rage?
Exactly.
And play some calming music or something like that. In this case, it's very clear, based on this research, I think we're going to see a change in these personal assistants. They're going to have to recognize when things are bad. Cases of abuse, rape, depression, suicidality, intense anger, that sort of thing. The next question, which is a little bit scary, we've had a kind of a preview of this, is what happens if you say, Siri, I want to go blow up a building.
Right.
You know, when does your personal assistant, in fact, become...
Not your assistant.
Yeah, evidence for the state. And right now we're trying to unlock past records, but is there an obligation among these programmers to actually alert people? I'm going to go kill Joe Smith. I am tired of him. It's time for me to kill him. Siri, show me how to kill Joe Smith. At that point, does Siri warn Joe Smith?
Well, I mean, it's funny, Tony. I mean, we don't have a whole lot of time to go into this, but, you know, this isn't something that's just common to your phone. You know, this is also things that are happening on social media. Things are coming across Twitter or various, you know, Instagram, Snapchat, all these various things that could be deemed needing some kind of external involvement. And do they deal with it? Do they not deal with it? Who's monitoring it? Who's not monitoring it? These are all good questions.
Well, look at the time. We have an intense ethical question. We have no answers, and we're going to take a break. Stay tuned for our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Flair Parish Show. It's our Kentucky way of saying flower power. And
sit back, roll down your window, and just have a good talk.
I grew up in rural Kentucky.
Me too.
I grew up hearing
rural.
But I will tell you, I never went with flair. I don't think, even looking back at home movies from when I was young, I had a really pronounced Kentucky dialect, but I don't think I ever said flair. I just heard, the reason we did flair pair, as a matter of fact, is I just heard someone say maybe we should send flares, and I thought about for the first time in a long time the way Kentuckians pronounce flower. Our sponsor for the second time, the Vaccination League, reminding you, don't be late, vaccination, the all-natural way to stimulate your immune system without involving harsh chemical vitamins or antibiotics. Vaccination like Mother Nature with a 23-gauge needle. We've got an advanced Vaccination League sponsor this particular show, 9 practice recommendations from the Southern Medical Journal, March 2016. First of all, we mentioned few absolute contraindications other than a severe reaction to a vaccine component. Usually, if you want to, or a problem with your immune system, usually if you want the vaccine, we can work out a way to get it. Secondly, we talked about this at length, whooping cough or pertussis vaccination, not only in children, but also in adults. And particularly, the message I want to leave you with is, if there is an infant headed for your home, vaccinate the family. Healthcare personnel maternal daycare employees, expectant fathers, grandparents, siblings, or other household members soon to be exposed to an infant, you could give that infant whooping cough, and that can be a very, very life-threatening, health-threatening infection for an infant. Number three, you can give flu vaccine even in the presence of a mild egg allergy. Even if you've had some problems with the egg allergies in the past, we can do that. The intranasal vaccine should not be given to anybody with an egg allergy, the one that you spray in your nose, but the inactivated can be done with mild egg allergies. You have to watch a little bit longer in the office. Number four, there are two pneumonia vaccines. You may have heard this on TV. There is a 23, one that protects against 23 different types of pneumococcus. That's what causes pneumonia, and that's been recommended. That's called Pneumovax. We've recommended that for years. We found out there's another one called PCV13 or Prevnar, and Prevnar doesn't protect against as many types, but boy, it really gooses your immune system. So now they recommend you do the initial goosing with the Prevnar, and then you follow it with the 23 valent, which protects against more different types. So there are, in fact, two pneumonia vaccines, and both are recommended. Talk to your doctor about sequencing these things. It is worthwhile to have both. If you are older than age 18, this is number five, and you are going to a dormitory in college, a military recruit, or if you're exposed during an outbreak, you're traveling to a different area, and or you're a lab scientist, you may need the meningococcal vaccine. Talk to your doctor about this. You do not want to send your child off this fall to a college dormitory without this. This is the thing that winds up within 24 hours killing or severely hurting college students after they enroll in college for the first time. Number six, hepatitis B virus. We have a vaccine against it. In most cases, we give the vaccine and assume you're immune. If you are a high-risk person, healthcare worker, chronic hemodialysis patient, somebody with a poor immune system, if your sexual partner has hepatitis B, we will want to make sure you get a booster, and we want to check and be sure you responded to it. You do not want to get hepatitis B. Number seven, if you have never had a tetanus shot, you really need three injections of tetanus in about a year to get started. For the rest of us, for Rick and me, we have had many, many tetanus shots. You do something stupid, go to the ER, get a tetanus shot.
You know,
do something stupid, go to the ER, get a tetanus shot.
I haven't had one in a while.
Well, every 10 years, they recommend it on the tens if you haven't done anything stupid in 10 years. I find that hard to believe personally, but if you're telling me you haven't done something stupid in 10 years, then you ought to get a tetanus shot.
I don't think I've been caught doing it.
And if you never did anything stupid, then you may need a series of three if you did not, if you're an adult and did not get the initial one. Number eight, hepatitis A vaccine, not only for travelers, it is recommended for all children in the U.S. now, and also those anticipating close personal contact with an international adoptee. If you're adopting a child from another country, you will need hepatitis A vaccine. And then finally, number nine, and this is a key one as well. If you're doing a series of vaccines, generally speaking, according to the Southern Medical Journal, vaccination series don't need to be restarted if time has lapsed. So these things like hepatitis A, hepatitis B, the HPV vaccine, it's sometimes hard to come exactly on time for your second or your third vaccination. If there is a time lapse, you do not need to start over. A useful piece of information from the Southern Medical Journal. That's our sponsor, Vaccination League. Don't be late. Vaccinate. Rick, you ever been to one of those retail clinics?
Nope.
That's in the Walmart, the drugstores,
nope.
Or things like that?
Never have.
In general, they have protocol-driven care. That is, if you have a certain problem, you pick that problem up on the board, there is a set price for that problem, they will do certain things for you. It turns out, and that you would think with protocols, then that would be a very economical way to get your health care. It turns out a study published in the March issue of Health Affairs, they found that visits to these clinics led to an additional $14 per person per year in health care spending. And 58% of the visits were new uses rather than substitutions for pricier consultations. That is, they're not going to this instead of a more expensive thing. They're going to this in addition to what they would have done before the new retail clinic was developed. So that convenience leads to more visits for relatively more minor things. We don't know if it improves overall health. I mean, if you want to get your ankle looked at, or if you want to do something about a viral infection, perfectly fine. But it does not look like it saves money. not known if it adds to health improvement. And again, that, there are other reasons why you would go to these things. You may not be able to get in with your regular doctor, feel that you have something that needs to be seen. But the discouraging thing is there was thought that with their protocol-driven care, they would be actually more inexpensive, and in fact, they're not. They, in general, most people in the medical community do not like these things for managing chronic illnesses. They're really set to manage sprains, respiratory infections, things like that, and not really set up very well to manage chronic diseases. They probably will become better about that. Currently, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends against their use for child health care chronic conditions, but they're set up for acute conditions. So I thought it was interesting. Just pass it on. The retail clinics have not saved money like we had hoped they might, and their role in the as far as being pivotal to health care in the future, there's going to be a lot of them. They'll have better hours and better convenience. Whether or not they improve our health care, still up for grabs. Got the March 8th press release and information from the American Society for Aesthetic Plastic Surgery. That's the ASAPS. This is the
Aesthetic
National Organization of Plastic Surgeons.
This is the, yeah, those guys.
Rick was about to say something profound, and then suddenly, I don't know what happened. A short circuit occurred.
The light
went
off. And
suddenly, he's back to being Rick.
No, I don't know. I mean, there's plastic surgeons. I mean, I know some plastic surgeons can do both things, but there's a lot of them that the ones you see on TV are augmenting, they're beautifying, they're doing things that aren't necessarily life-saving or, you know, reconstructive surgery after a mastectomy or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just, you know, so which association is this? I guess, are they all lumped into the same one?
Yeah, this is national data on plastic surgery. Americans spent more than $13.5 billion, with a B, dollars on combined surgical and non-surgical procedures in 2015. Non-surgical, things like Botox and other injections. Surgical, obviously, would be the going to the OR. $13.5 billion. That's a $1.5 billion increase combined since 2014. So if you wonder how the economy is going, the economy apparently is $1.5 billion more plastic surgery better off than it was a year ago.
Okay.
Or $1.45 billion more desperate than it was a year ago. Maybe. Surgical procedures, 58% of the total. So that is a lot of money in that $13.5 billion. Again, 58% of the total. You're looking at a good $5, $6 billion there going for non-surgical procedures, for injections. Non-surgical procedures, again, 42%. Surgical procedures up 7% with, it looks like, almost 2 million procedures performed. They're up 7%. The non-surgical stuff up 22%. We love to get our injections. The most popular surgical procedure. What do you think the most popular plastic surgery procedure was? 400,000 procedures performed in 2015.
Rhinoplasty.
Liposuction. Ew. Rhinoplasty, not even close.
I was guessing.
I
wasn't
going to
say breast augmentation.
Yeah, and it was not. First time this year, fat grafting was reported. That's where you basically take fat from somewhere and put it somewhere else where you really want it to be a little bit bigger.
What?
18,000 fat grafting for the breast, 18,000 to the buttocks, and 48,000 to the face. You transfer it because you don't like the way your cheeks are or the way your cheeks are or the way your cheeks are. Is that fair? Hopefully I made my point. Cosmetic procedures increased by 39% over the past 5 years. Surgical procedures up 17%. Non-surgical up 44%. Your most significant increases between 2014 and 2015. Non-surgical skin tightening. And I'm not sure what that means. But at any rate, whatever it is, non-surgical skin tightening up 58%. I don't know if that's injections to tighten the skin or not. Tattoo removals. Let this be a lesson to you young folks. Tattoo removal is up 39% between 2014 and 2015. There are a lot of tattoos coming off in 2015 that were on in 2014. Microdermabrasion up 34%. Buttock lifts up 32%.
I have a hard time taking you serious when you say buttock lifts.
Well, I like the idea that the buttock lifts are up 32%. I mean, if my buttocks were a third higher than they were last year,
you couldn't wear your pants.
Maybe I misunderstood that statistic, but buttock lifts are up 32%. Male breast
people are
reduction,
getting taller, Tony.
Male breast reduction. Here we go. I knew we couldn't. There was no way we were going to finish this one without the giggling.
I'm not the one turning red.
Absolutely right. Male breast reduction, that's the man boobs, up 26%. Yeah. A surgical Man-boob reduction up 26%. Injectables, talking about Botox, Dysport, Juvederm, Juvederm Ultra Plus, Perlane, polylactic acid, restyling, Voluma. I really don't know about these things, to be honest. 21% increase in 2015, and about two-thirds of these are performed in an office facility, about 12%, again, some of the major surgical procedures in hospital. The top five, we mentioned liposuction number one. Rick, breast augmentation still holding on to number two overall, 300,000 procedures. A tummy tuck, apparently as distinct from liposuction, number three at 180,000. Eyelid surgery, and eyelid surgery, interesting enough, is mostly with older people. That's about 180,000. A breast lift without augmentation, but simply a lift, is 150,000 procedures. The top five non-surgical procedures, Botox, 4 million and counting. Hyaluronic acid, which fills in wrinkles, 2 million. Hair removal. Let's not forget hair removal. Hair removal, over 1 million. A chemical peel, 600,000. Microdermabrasion, 600,000. For women, obviously, liposuction number one, breast augmentation number two, tummy tuck, breast lift, and eyelid surgery. For men, liposuction was number one. Number two, though, Rick, you were correct, mainly number two, nose surgery. Eyelid surgery number three, male breast reduction number four, and a facelift. Men get facelifts. Why not just grow a beard?
Exactly.
Why would you go through surgery?
It hides at least two of your chins.
The first two. Now, the third one, you're on your own.
Hey, at some point, you got to start thinking, you know.
Women had 11.5 million cosmetic procedures, men 1.2 million procedures. I was trying to think, Rick, you know, what would what hideous abnormality would make me go to get plastic surgery? Honestly, I would have to get pretty darn ugly. I'll just tell you before I would do that.
Okay. How much more ugly? I'm just saying.
Rick's going to
Define it for me.
Rick's gonna, he's going to look at his watch. During one show, he's going to say, Tony, it's time.
Do we have 5 minutes left in this segment. You got 5 minutes.
I understand. We'll try to make it. I'm sorry. But isn't it interesting? I mean, $13 billion worth of plastic surgery.
Yeah, that's a lot.
That is really a lot.
And, you know, and the thing is $13 billion worth of, that's money infused into the medical system that had probably a relatively high percentage of profit taken out of it.
Probably so.
And that's the hard part.
You know, and we, in the South, we do the cheap stuff. We'll do tanning beds and things like that. But we are not really we're one of the lowest areas, South and Midwest, and also the up in the New England states, even up, even down to Massachusetts, are the lowest regions in the country.
Well, because again, it's the majority of the work is elective.
Yeah,
right. It's pay as you go, and that's in Kentucky. We don't have a lot of available cash to throw at this.
But it's really odd because California and New York, you would expect to have a lot of plastic surgery. Florida, not quite as much. And Massachusetts, which I would have thought would have been a real center for plastic surgery, is actually one of the lower parts in the nation. It's about the same as the
South. I
would
still have thought California carries their weight in plastic surgery.
Oh, yeah. They and New York State, highest areas
in the
nation.
I would think a lot of it's probably a bit in Texas, too, just because it's a large state. It's got a lot of ocean.
I don't have
the
full report in front of me. I don't remember where it was, but I remember looking, and I saw, obviously, the South has a low rate. The Midwest has a low rate. And the New England states, including Massachusetts.
Alaska, pretty low on the list.
Yeah. Yeah, why would you, once again, you just, it's dark most of the time. That's the thing. The land.
Well, or
the,
light.
Well,
it's one or the other.
Yeah, but it's when it's light, it's not overhead, direct overhead light.
Right.
So in a low light, I look pretty good.
Well,
so if I moved to Alaska.
I mean, that is debatable.
I could be considered handsome most of the year in Alaska. Just pointing that out.
So for the rest of the show, I'm going to call you Matt Damon. So you can be Matt Damon for this, because it's low light in here.
It is,
right?
Yeah.
So, no, can't do that.
Okay, March 11th, this was actually came the American Academy of Neurology annual meeting, and this was a study of street lighting that I think was misinterpreted. I'll just tell you what they did. They interviewed a representative sample, 15,000 people across the U.S. by phone over a period of 7 years, and they asked them about their sleep habits, including when they went to bed, how much sleep they got, when they woke up, and so forth. They also provided information on eating habits, time and composition, and so forth. And then here's the really interesting part, Rick. To determine the amount of external light that they were exposed to, they used a nighttime light radiance database from the Defense Meteorological Satellite Program's operational line scan system. So what they did is they would call you up and they would say, Rick, how much do you sleep? And then they would go hit your GPS location and measure the amount of light in your area from this Defense Meteorological Satellite Program. Now, the question is, I mean, they're obvious question, and it's a really simple question, is if you are in an area that has a lot of light, a lot of artificial light at night, do you have, in fact, lower, worse sleep habits?
But they're not talking about light that fluctuates or flashes or strobes. They're talking about a consistent, like a sunlight kind of thing, where it's direct, it's or subtle, or but it doesn't change. You know, we're not talking about lightning flashes in the night. We're
That's
talking
correct.
About...
Yeah, so you and I've always wondered that, you know, you see these strobe lights on the top of a tower, and sometimes those are things are really annoying, and I
Absolutely.
Wonder what they would
and
do.
In the wintertime where I live, there's one out at the lake. When the leaves are off the trees, that big red light comes right through the trees, and you can see it right through our bedroom window. Doesn't bother me, but yeah. Nothing a blinds can't take
but
care
of. But this is, you know, when you get those satellite pictures of the Earth and you can see a country
Absolutely.
Outlined in light, they're measuring the light from that, except they obviously have more of a close-up. They mentioned people with high light exposure, according to satellite data, slept an average of 402 minutes per night, and if you had low light, you had 412 minutes. So you got 10 minutes average. And that's, again, when you average that across 15,000 people, that is quite a bit of extra sleep, high light versus low light. Exposure to greater night light was associated with increased daytime sleepiness, the likelihood of having a circadian rhythm disorder, being dissatisfied with your sleep quantity and quality. Of those living in high radiance areas, 16% were dissatisfied with their sleep quality compared to 7% in low radiance areas. They said that the other thing is confusional arousals. You wake up in the middle of the night, you think that you need to get up, 5% more likely in the high light area. Fatigue levels about 2% higher in that. Excessive sleepiness and impaired functioning about 5% higher.
We're going to turn the lights off.
Yeah, I guess we should, because we are certainly functioning in an impaired fashion. We're going to take a break, take a nap, and see if we can adjust our light levels so that even Rick look handsome. Tune in for our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. We've turned the lights back on. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
And unfortunately, nothing has changed visually from my side of
Me
the studio.
Me either.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Flower Power Show, the Flower Power Show, for those of you who are not from Kentucky. Our salute to spring flares and the way they make us feel. Our sponsor for the final time, the Vaccination League. Don't be late. Vaccinate. Vaccination, the all-natural way to stimulate your immune system without using harsh chemical vitamins or antibiotics. That's right. Vaccination is like Mother Nature with a 23-gauge needle. And this one just makes you think. This is back from February of 2016, and it was out of Taiwan, an observational study published February 1st in the journal Heart Rhythm. It turns out if you get the flu, influenza infection, it increases your risk of an irregular heartbeat called atrial fibrillation. Now, you've seen those commercials about atrial fibrillation not due to a heart valve problem and you should use this new blood thinner medicine. This is a common condition, relatively a common irregular heartbeat that happens to people as they get older. And it appears that getting the flu actually increases your risk of atrial fibrillation according to this observational study. Now, here's the big deal. If you got the flu vaccine, your risk of getting atrial fibrillation in an influenza epidemic drops by 12%. 12% less likely to get an irregular heart rhythm if you've had the flu vaccine. And so if you're sitting there saying, well, I think I can handle the flu. Last time I got it, it wasn't that bad. I'm saying, yeah, but what about an irregular heartbeat? The flu is rough on your system. It's rough on your respiratory system. It is rough on your overall health. It paves the way for pneumonia and other respiratory infections. And apparently, it increases your risk of getting this irregular heartbeat called atrial fibrillation. And this can be a real nasty thing. Why not protect yourself from the flu? Why not protect the people around you from catching the flu from you? Why not protect your respiratory status, your risk of hospitalization, your risk of dying, and your risk of atrial fibrillation? We do not understand why you do not get the flu vaccine. It's too late now this year, but maybe next fall, you should consider the flu vaccine for all the reasons outlined above. That's our sponsor, Vaccination League, reminding you, don't be late. Vaccinate. Vaccination, like Mother Nature, with a 23-gauge needle. Rick, good news. Generic Viagra is on the way.
Hello.
Yes, the FDA.
You know, we talk, we don't really talk a lot about that, do we?
No.
We try to stay away from those topics.
Well, you know, this was a weird show. As you well know, we were doing some catch-up. Rick and I have both been traveling. We're trying to put together some stuff. And so I've got plastic surgery and erectile drugs on the same show. And you're absolutely right. These are two things that we vowed not to talk much about. But I think in each case, there was a news development that made me think about it. So whether it is plastic surgery being a record high $13.5 billion worth of plastic surgery being done, or the fact that we have generic Viagra on the way. Now, let me explain on the way. Teva Pharmaceuticals will make the 25, 50, and 100 milligrams tablets. That's the standard doses. They have reached an agreement with Pfizer, who has the brand name Viagra. They will launch the generic drug in 2017. It will be available in December 2017. So, you will have to, we will call it, hold your horses. You will have to work things out. You will have to pay brand name prices until December 2017. At that point, the Teva manufacturer will have exclusive rights to the generic drug for 180 days. And I believe after 180 days, then it's Katie Barrett or anybody who can make Viagra and passes FDA muster will be able to sell Viagra. I am not absolutely certain. Viagra in 2013 had sales of $1.2 billion. That's not plastic surgery levels, but it's still a pretty good amount of money. And there is no mention right now of what that price of that generic Viagra will be, but it is coming.
I don't know, Tony. I'm sure there are men going to rejoice all around the world, but it just doesn't. Would it be bad to say it doesn't do it for me?
You are a skeptic. You are also a young man.
I am much closer to 50 than I am to any other number.
That's true. That's fair enough.
And
all right.
I mean, you know, so is the whole idea of, you know, generic, you know, Viagra, you know, is that to offset the fact that I'm going to have to start the colonoscopies? I mean, what's the deal here? I mean,
my job is to analyze, Rick, this show. And so, first of all, you have to start thinking ahead, I think, in that regard. But here's one that this will catch you off guard. This was the Wall Street Journal, March 11th. There is that Parker Hannifin, which is a company, has a robotic exoskeleton for use in people with spinal cord injuries, and they've got the FDA okay for personal use. The FDA has said Parker Hannifin can now market this, but these exoskeletons cost $80,000 a piece.
Ouch.
There are two companies now making it, the Parker Group and also something called ReWalk. They have had FDA approval, and they've been selling these things for a while. Now, what happens is, this is, by the way, you'll like this, the name of their exoskeleton is Indigo.
Indigo.
Right. And so it's a color, except they spell it with a D-E-G-O. And what it means is you're indigo with your exoskeleton, even though you have a spinal cord injury. The device weighs 26 pounds. You strap it on. Possibly 1.7 million people could do it. 270,000 people with spinal cord injuries. 12,000 suffer injuries annually. So this is a pretty big deal. And again, we've gotten more concerned about these things after all the bomb victims we've had in our military. Hydraulics parts, aircraft systems, pumps, and dozens of other components. This company had 12 billion sales last year, and they became interested in this when they wanted to redirect their pump and motor systems for something other than aircrafts. Now, the ReWalk, the company that has one, they sold 73 units last year. 73 robotic exoskeletons. Again, the price on this one is going to be around $80,000 a piece. They made $3.5 million off of 73 devices. But I mean, these are really expensive devices. They are, as you can imagine. I mean, they got to be proven safety to use. They've got to maintain person's balance and so forth. You can't just simply strap something on. You know, I'm thinking the thing. Here's the thing, Rick. Let's say, and I would wish this on you, I promise, but let's say you had a devastating spinal cord injury right now. The microphone suddenly comes loose and severs your spinal cord right now. You're paralyzed.
Okay.
You're not going to buy this.
Right.
You're not going to.
I can't afford it.
No, well, that's not it. Even if you had a government, you had a grant to buy it, you still want. You know why? Because right now you're wearing Crocs.
Right.
And these Crocs have a strap on the back of them. And what are you doing with the strap on the back of your Crocs?
Pushed forward.
That's pushed forward. The thing about the exoskeleton, it will work perfectly fine, but you won't strap that thing on. You're going going to try to just to jam your legs in the exoskeleton just like you jam your feet in the Crocs, and you're not going to use it.
Well, I have a feeling if I was facing a debilitating injury and I had the ability to walk again, something tells me I might change my belief about the Crocs.
I'm just saying.
I really think you're underestimating me.
You're
kind of putting me into a little bitty box.
You are worse than I am, and I realize I couldn't wear this thing. I was thinking about it the other day.
But you're looking at it from your perspective right now.
Right. I was in the house, and I was thinking, I need to go out to the garage. I need to get a piece of hardware.
Right.
And I thought, do I want to put my shoes on and lace them up to go to the garage?
No, of course not.
And I said,
You have a pair by the door. You slip them on.
I had a pair of slippers, and I realized, look, I was reading this. The interesting was I was reading this article, and I thought, you know, I need to go fix that before I forget. And I was going to go out the garage, and I thought, I don't want to put my shoes on. And I thought, if I don't want to put my shoes on, how am I ever going to put on a robotic exoskeleton?
It's going to be a little different. It's going to be a pleasure to put that on.
It's going to take longer than it takes to lace up my shoes, certainly. And I wasn't willing to do that. I was willing just to kind of slop out to the garage rather than lace up the shoes or wait till tomorrow morning.
You don't think the person's going to get up in the morning, put that on, and then not take it off until bedtime?
I don't know. I believe that you would do that for some type of exercise. The problem is, you know, staying upright, one, there's blisters, and the other thing is if you have a spinal cord injury, it messes with your blood pressure. It's not only just the nerves that make your muscles move. Also those that keep your blood pressure up when you're upright.
I am left with no other option but to believe that you would not wear your exoskeleton.
That's right.
Do
you want your exoskeleton? No, I'll just wear Crocs.
It looks good in the corner, though. Right? But I mean, think about it, Tony. We could rename you Tony Iron Man Weaver.
That I could walk around. You know, people have done, and I believe it was in London, a person ran a marathon with an exoskeleton. It took days. You know, they were days after the finish of the thing, but they actually completed the marathon, a person who was unable to walk using the exoskeleton. So these things, they're nothing to sneeze at. They're really interesting devices. I'm just not sure I'm willing to put up with all the strap-ons. What we need is shoes and exoskeletons that you activate a button and they inflate and they cradle you. If
right.
I could jump in the thing and push a button, I'm fine.
Tony, if you could jump in the thing, you wouldn't need an exoskeleton.
If I could lower myself in the thing and push a button, I'd be fine. But I'm not going to do it.
I honestly think you're reaching. I think you're putting yourself up on a big old pedestal that if you had a debilitating spinal cord injury, you'd love that exoskeleton. You'd wear it all the time. You'd go to Walmart and walk laps.
Walk around in my exoskeleton.
Well, again,
this brings up a point we've talked before. If I had the choice between an exoskeleton that would enable me to lift 10,000 pounds or a robot that works with me,
you'd take the exoskeleton.
You think so?
Of course you would, because you're doing it.
Yeah, I guess so. You know,
Siri, move that log.
Yeah, and
no, Tony.
You want me to look up log for you?
Siri, what do you plan to do with that log?
Siri would not have a clue.
No, I'm saying, but I mean, you know that I know you. You get satisfaction, and I don't think you have a front loader on your tractor, do you?
I don't. I get satisfaction in doing things myself.
So you do get satisfaction, but the minute you put the front loader on it, it's a good feeling. But I can only imagine the power of that front loader in my arms.
Yeah.
Right? So if I had a big, massive exoskeleton I was wearing that made me 100 times stronger, and I could go lift the tree myself, I wouldn't use my tractor.
Yeah. And these are like the things that they had on the movie about the other planet. And I'm forgetting the name of it.
Mars.
Avatar.
Oh. Avatar, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, these are like the things, those big suits in Avatar. Again, they could be, these things are normal size, but they do give you an assist, and they create strength greater than human strength. And so, I guess you're probably right. I would prefer an exoskeleton that would enable me to lift things, and I could just walk around with tree trunks over my shoulder, over the exoskeleton shoulder, rather than having a bunch of robots scurrying around and doing things wrong while I watch it. It would be so annoying to have to keep correcting the robots. Why not? I just picked the tree up myself.
Exactly.
I guess so. All right. I got good and bad research, and I'll explain to you why the good is good and the bad is bad. First of all, the good stuff. This was one from World Economic Forum, March 2nd. Being generous can improve your physical health. I thought this was interesting. They looked at people who volunteered regularly. After 5 years of volunteering regularly, study participants, all ages, 55 and older, spent more time helping others they were 44% more likely to be alive than in the control group. Now, once again, all these studies start with the possibility that healthier people behave differently, but still, 44% more likely to be alive if you volunteered regularly. Now, what these people did, which was interesting, they said, well, okay, let's stop doing these observational studies. Let's try to do a randomized study of helping people.
Ooh.
That's hard to do.
Right.
Name's Ashley Willens. She is a PhD student at University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And here's how she did it. She had 128 adults between age 65 and 85, senior citizens. She gave them $40 a week for 3 weeks. Half of the participants, half the people said, spend the money on yourself. The other half, they told them, spend it on someone else, but you have to spend all this $40 a week in one day. I give you an elderly person, I give you $40, tell you buy something for yourself this day or spend it on someone else, and they measure their blood pressure.
Okay.
The people who were previously diagnosed with high blood pressure, spending money on other people lowered their blood pressure throughout the duration of the study. Spending money, the effects of spending money on other people, $40 once a week, have to spend it in a day. The effects were similar to blood pressure medicines and exercise. The people who had high blood pressure and spent money on themselves, no change in blood pressure.
Really?
Yes.
So doing good makes you feel good.
Yep. There were significant improvements to blood pressure when they spent money on family and friends rather than strangers. Didn't, you know, the study, it doesn't say, well, how much money would it take? How often do you have to do it? How strange do the strangers have to be? Could you maybe help out, you know, your cousins or help your spouse, and then your spouse would come back and spend it on you? All those things are not known. But that, in my mind, is good research. It's the first time someone has designed a randomized trial where you don't necessarily just pick a bunch of generous people and watch them. You actually create generous people by giving them money with directions to spend it on other people. I thought that was a cool thing, and it turned out it did create some benefit. Now, let me show you bad science here. This one was a study from the University of Bath in England. And I mean right away, the University of Bath.
Ugh.
You think to yourself, what kind of a university is a Bath?
Probably a lukewarm bath.
Yeah, I don't know. That's not the place where you learn stuff. All right. They concluded a helmet, a bicycle helmet or a helmet of any type, may actually make you take more risks. And I saw this thing reported. I've got it in something called Modern Healthcare, but I saw the networks actually pick this thing up. It may be that wearing a helmet makes you take more risks. This was published in January.
You think you feel safer, huh?
In Psychological Science, and they were looking at risk, sensation-seeking risk-taking in adults ages 17 to 56. This is Tim Gamble and Ian Walker in the psychology department, and I'm sure they're nice people, but I don't like their research. Here's what they did. They had 80 people in their study, split them into two groups, and they told them, and this is common in a study, they misled them. They said, we're going to do eye tracking while you do an experiment. One group wore a bicycle helmet with a camera that they said was for eye tracking, and the other group wore a baseball cap. So you got 80 people. Half of them get a baseball cap. Half of them get a helmet. Now, here's the experiment. They were asked to inflate an animated balloon that appeared on a computer screen while wearing a helmet.
Inflate an animated balloon
while wearing a helmet. The balloon inflations would earn you points, but if a balloon popped, all your points would be lost. So how much will you inflate the balloon?
Right.
The people with the helmet inflated the animated balloon more than the people with the baseball cap.
They got more risky.
That's it. That's the study.
They don't tell you how.
Do you think that inflating an animated balloon is the same as taking risk in traffic, the same as taking risk?
No, of course
risk?
Not.
No. This is
why did you read enough to this article to get to the end of it?
Well, because I was thinking it's really important. If helmets make you do riskier things, our radio fans need to know that. And then I came away saying, this is just not good research. This is stupid.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Okay, speaking of stupid, get us off the air.
Yeah, I'm glad this one's over. Special thanks to Morehead State Public Radio producer Hunter Reese and to Eric Bilby, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
Health Matters is a human papillomavirus vaccine that helps protect against four types of HPV. In girls and young women ages 9 to 26, Health Matters helps protect against two types of HPV that cause 70% of cervical cancer cases.
In males and females ages 9 to 26, Health Matters helps protect against about 80% of anal cancer cases and 90% of genital warts cases. Health Matters may not fully protect everyone, nor will it protect against diseases not caused by HPV.
Side effects of Health Matters include pain, swelling, itching, bruising, and redness at the listening site. Headache, fever, nausea, dizziness, vomiting, and fainting.
Fainting can happen after listening to our show. Sometimes people who faint can fall and hurt themselves. For this reason, your child's health care professional may ask your child to sit or lie down for 15 minutes after he or she listens to Health Matters.
Sit. Some people who faint may shake or become stiff. This may require evaluation or treatment by your child's health care professional. Only a doctor or health care professional can decide if Health Matters is right for your child.
Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Well, I mean, if you're going to faint, you should. But other than that, get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for our continuing salute to U.S. ophthalmologists who explain how the senses work with the I Can't Hear You program on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.